That would be wrong, to steal from a people. He put renewed tension to the bowstring as she let out a noisy breath of frustration. If I make a bow to trade, everyone knows it is the work of Chandelin, because it is such a fine bow. If anyone steals it, everyone knows what it is and where it came from, and the thief would be caught and be made to give it back. Maybe he would be sent away from his people. How do these people tell who the money belongs to if it is taken by a thief?
Kalin's mind reeled from the effort of trying to explain such things to Chandelin. At least, it was keeping her from having to think about the dead all about her. She started walking again through the snow, having to step over a man's back because there was no way around. They were fallen so close.
It is difficult. Because of this, people guard their money. If anyone is caught stealing, a punishment is severe to discourage thieving.
Are thieves punished?
If they didn't steal much, and are lucky, they might be locked in a small room until their family can make reparations for what they stole.
Locked. What is this?
A lock is a way of barring a door. The stone rooms that thieves are placed in have a door they are not able to open from the inside. It has a lock on it, and you must have a key, the right key, to open it, so they cannot get out.
Chandelin checked the side street beyond a silversmith's shop as they continued up the main road.
I would rather be put to death than be locked in a room.
If the thief stole from the wrong person or is unlucky, that is what happens to him.
Chandelin grunted. She didn't think she was doing a very good job of explaining things to him. He seemed to think the whole scheme unworkable.
Our way is better. We make what we want. Everyone makes what they need. This specializing way is not our way. We trade only for a few things. Our way is better.
You do the same as these people, Chandelin. You may not realize it, but you do.
No. Each person knows many things. We teach all our children to know how to do everything they need.
You specialize. You're a hunter, and more than that, you're a protector to your people.
She nodded once again to the dead around her. Some stared back with flat eyes.
Their people. They gave their lives trying to protect their people. You're the same as they, a soldier. You're strong. You are good with a bow and a spear, and you are good at discovering and preparing to thwart the various ways others would try to harm your people.
Chandelin thought this over for a moment as he stopped briefly to knock a heavy clump of snow from the binding of a snowshoe.
But that is only me, because I am so strong and wise. Others of my people do not specialize.
Everyone specializes, Chandelin. Nissal, the healer, she specializes at helping sick or injured people. She spends most of her time helping others. How does she feed herself?
Though she helps give her what she needs, and if there is no one to help so she can be offered food by them, then others who have enough offer some of theirs so Nissal will be well fed and ready to help us.
You see? Those she helps pay her with tava bread, but it's the same thing almost as they do here with money. Because she specializes in a service to the village, everyone helps a little so she will be there for the village when there is need of her. Here that's called a tax. When everyone pays a little toward the good of the group, to help support those who work for all the people.
Is this how you get your food? The people all give for you, like we do when you come to make trouble for us?
She was relieved that for the first time he didn't say it with enmity.
Yes.
Chandelin eyed empty second-floor windows as they walked on among buildings that were becoming larger and more ornate. The double, iron-strap-hinged doors to an inn on their left were broken in, and tables, chairs, pots, dishes, and linen embroidered with red roses, apparently to echo the inn's name, the Red Rose, had been thrown into the street, where they were half covered over with the snow. Through the empty doorway she could see the body of an apron-clad kitchen boy sprawled on the floor, his eyes staring up at the ceiling, frozen with the terror of his last vision. He couldn't have been over 12.
But that is just the hunters and Nissal, Chandelin added, after some thought. Others of us do not do this specializing.
Everyone does, to some degree. The women bake the tava bread, the men make the weapons. Nature is that way too. Some plants grow where it is wet, some where it is dry. Some animals eat grass, some leaves, some bugs, and some other animals. Everything plays its part. Women have the babies, and men...
She halted, fists at her sides, staring at the countless bodies fallen all around her. She swept her arm out.
And men, it would seem, are here to kill everything. You see, Chandelin, women's specialty is to bring forth life, and men's specialty is to take it away.
Kaylin clenched her fist against her stomach. She was dangerously close to losing her composure. Nausea swept through her. Her head spun. Chandelin stole a glimpse at her from the corner of his eye.
The Birdman would say not to judge all by what some do. And women do not make life alone. Men are part of that, too.
Kaylin gulped cold air. With a struggle, she started off again, shuffling her snowshoes ahead. Chandelin let her set a quicker pace as he walked beside her. She turned them up a street lined with fine shops. As she moved up and then down a snowdrift, he pointed with his bow, seeming to look for an excuse to change the subject.
Why do they have wooden people here?
A headless mannequin rested at an angle against a window sill, tipped halfway out of a shop. The elaborate blue dress the mannequin wore was trimmed with white beads draped in layers about the waist. Glad to have a diversion from the thoughts swirling in her head, Kaylin changed direction a little, toward the mannequin in the blue dress.
This is a tailor's shop. The people who owned this shop specialized in making clothes. This wooden person is simply a form to display what they make, so others may know the fine work they do. It's a demonstration of pride in their work.
She stopped before the large window. All the panes of glass were broken out. A few of the yellow-painted mullions hung crookedly from the top of the frame. The shade of blue of the gorgeous gown reminded Kaylin of her wedding dress. She could feel the blood pounding in the veins of her neck as she swallowed back a cry. Chandelin watched both directions up and down the street as her hand slowly reached out to touch the frozen blue fabric. Her vision focused past the mannequin into the shop, where a square of sunlight fell across the snow-dusted floor and up and over a low work counter. Her hand faltered. A dead man with a balding head was pinned to the wall by a spear through his chest. A woman lay sprawled face down over the counter, her dress and underskirts bunched up around her waist, exposing blue flesh. A pair of tailor's scissors juddered from her back. In the gloom at the far end of the room stood another mannequin, in a fine man's coat. The front of the dark coat was shredded with hundreds of small cuts. The soldiers had evidently used the mannequin as a target for knife throwing while they waited their turn on the woman. Apparently, when they were finished with her, they stabbed her to death with her scissors. Kaylin twisted away from the shop to find herself face to face with Chandelin. His was red. There was menace in his eyes.
Not all men are the same. I would cut the throat of any man of mine if he did such a thing.
Kaylin had no answer for him, and suddenly wasn't in the mood to talk. As she started off again, she loosened the mantle at her neck, needing the feel of cold air. In silence, but for the low, baleful moan of the breeze between the buildings, they slogged past stables of horses, their throats all cut, and past inns and grand houses, their cornices high overhead, shading them from the bright, slanting sunlight. Fluted, wooden columns to each side of one door had been hacked at with a sword, seemingly for no purpose but to deface the elegance of the home. It was colder in the shade, but she didn't care. They stepped over corpses that lay face down in the snow with wounds in their backs, and around overturned wagons and coaches and dead horses and dead dogs. It all melted into a meaningless madness of destruction. Eyes cast to the ground before her, she trudged on through the snow. The cold air bit into her flesh, and she pulled her mantle closed once more. The cold was sapping her of not only warmth, but strength. With grim determination, she put one foot in front of the other, continuing on toward her destination, hoping, somehow, that she would never reach it. With the frozen dead of Ebenicia all about, she filled her crushing loneliness with a silent prayer.
Please, dear spirits, keep Richard warm.
Chapter 28. Naked under the sun's fury, the parched, dead, flat ground stretched endlessly before them, in the distance offering up shimmering images to waver and dance in the sun's furnace glare, like phantom hostages surrendered to an omnipotent foe. Behind, the fractured hills ended in a bank of rocky rubble. The silence was as oppressive as the heat. Richard wiped sweat from his brow on the back of his sleeve. The leather of his saddle creaked as he shifted his weight while he waited. Bonnie and the other two horses waited, too. Their ears pricked ahead as they occasionally pawed the cracked, dry earth and voiced apprehensive snorts. Sister Verna sat motionless atop Jessup, scrutinizing the nothingness of the distance as if viewing an event of great import. Except for the way her brown curls hung limp, she didn't appear to be affected by the heat.
"I don't understand this weather,"
It's winter. I've never heard of it being hot like this in winter.
The weather is different in different places, she murmured.
No, it's not. When it's winter, it's cold. It's only hot like this in high summer.
Have you ever seen snow on mountaintops in the summer?
Richard reversed the positions of his hands resting on the pommel. Yes, but that's just on mountaintops. The air is colder up there. We're not on a mountaintop.
Still, she did not move. Not just mountaintops have different weather. In the south, the weather is not so cold as it is in the north. But this place is different still. It's like an inexhaustible well of heat.
And just what is this place?
The Valley of the Lost, she whispered.
Who was lost in it?
Those who created it, and whoever enters. At last she turned a bit to peer at him. It's the end of the world. Your world, anyway.
He shifted his weight to the other side when Bonnie did the same. If it's the end of the world, why are we here?
Sister Verna held her hand up to the land behind. Just as there is Westland, where you were born, separated from the Midlands, and the Midlands from Dahara, so too are those lands separated from what lies on the far side of this place.
Richard frowned. And what lies on the other side of here?
She turned back to the expanse before them. You lived in the New World. Across this valley lies the Old World.
The Old World? I never heard of the Old World.
Few in the New World have. It has been sealed away and forgotten. This valley, the Valley of the Lost, separates them, much the same way the boundary used to separate the three lands of the New World. The last of the country we have been crossing has been inhospitable, a desert wasteland. Anyone venturing through it and into this valley never returns. People think there is nothing beyond, that this is the southern end of the Midlands and Dahara, with nothing beyond but what you see here, an endless waste, where one could die of thirst and hunger and you could have your bones baked by the heat of the sun.